Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. I want to start off today by wishing everyone a happy Thanksgiving. And in the spirit of the holiday, we start off with some Thanksgiving information. How will the cost of this year's traditional Thanksgiving dinner compare with what we paid last year? Gary Crawford has the answer in this report.
One of the few good things that happened in 2020 was that the cost of the Thanksgiving dinner actually went down from 2019 by about 4%. But what about this year's dinner? Well, we asked Carolyn Chelius. She's the economist who tracks retail food prices for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We asked her to take a look at some of the main items in a traditional Thanksgiving dinner and give us a cost analysis. And she said excitedly...
Yes,
very excited. She didn't look at every possible food, but a few of the items most often served for a Thanksgiving dinner, the same list she used last year. So, Carolyn, what products are on that list?
One whole frozen turkey, which is 12 pounds, 3 pounds of sweet potatoes, 3 pounds of russet potatoes, 1 pound of cranberries, 1 pound of green beans, a gallon of milk.
No, partridges. No, that's okay. So, okay, let's see what's happened to those real products price-wise. And if you do the grocery shopping yourself, you may know already. But Carolyn says not one of the foods on the list is costing less than last year. And as it turns out...
The only price that stayed the same was sweet potatoes, and those prices did not increase.
They've been selling for 99 cents a pound on average. Now, we have your standard russet potatoes. They're up from last year by 2.3% at 89 cents a pound. Surprisingly, the food item with the biggest price increase is...
Green beans.
They are up from a year ago by how much?
Almost 50%.
Ooh, 47.7% at $1.92 for 1 pound of green beans. Next highest price hike?
Cranberries, an increase of 12%.
At an average $2.49 for a 12-ounce bag. Next, what do we got?
Got milk?
Oh, yes, you got milk. Milk prices are up an average of 8% from last Thanksgiving at about $2.98 a gallon. Finally, the guest of honor... No, that's not a real turkey. That's famous stooge Curly Howard with his imitation of this real turkey. Anyway, Carolyn Chelius says the average of store specials around the country for turkey is sale price of $1.06 a pound. That's up more than 10% from last year. Now comes the math. And so, Carolyn, for our listed items in the listed amounts...
The total cost of that will be $25.81, and that compares to $23.33. in 2020. So that's a 10.6% price increase from 2020 to 2021 for a Thanksgiving meal.
Oh, dear. Yeah, well, maybe to save money, I'll suffer. I'll just have a non-traditional meal this year. Maybe just some peanut butter on a stale cracker.
Oh.
Oh. No, actually, I can't do that. According to the latest Consumer Price Index, peanut butter is 6% higher this year than last year. Oh, dear.
Well, I can't help you for your non-traditional Thanksgiving meal. You enjoy your peanut butter.
Oh, I will. Actually, even at a little higher price, that Thanksgiving dinner compared to what people in other countries pay is a huge bargain. So thank you, farmers. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The most common mistake that home cooking beginners make is made before the actual cooking begins. More from Gary Crawford in this report.
And now, once again, it's Cooking with the Cuckoos, Mo, Larry, and Curly.
My husband's birthday and no one to cook the dinner.
We'll cook it for you.
Do we know how to cook?
Do we?
Oh, all right. Now, you know the kind of mistakes these guys are going to make in the kitchen. For example, Curly follows the recipe for stuffing a turkey.
Half a dozen oysters.
Of course, they go in shells and all.
A can of peas.
That goes in the turkey can and all.
Yuck.
And the crowning achievement...
Get the gas.
Gas on.
Inflating a fallen birthday cake by pumping it full of gas from the gas stove. You know how that will end up when the birthday boy blows out the candles. Ah, but these are stooge mistakes, not real ones. But one expert says during this time with many of us doing more cooking at home, some of us pretty much for the first time, what's the biggest, most common mistake that most people make?
People don't take time to plan.
That's Lisa Martin, a dietitian and extension food expert with Kansas State University. She has taught classes on meal preparation and also done consumer surveys. And this planning thing shows up quite a bit on both counts. Not planning meals and not planning food buying may not rank up there with blowing up the cake, of course, but it can wreck an honest effort at cooking at home.
If you're not planning to have a well-stocked kitchen or you're not writing out a grocery list, you end up short on time and then tend to buy more of the convenience foods. And then we know it's more difficult to control things like the fat and the sugar and the salt, which is one of the benefits of cooking and eating more at home, is that you have a better opportunity to do that.
And without a plan, without the foods on hand, do we then go into a panic mode, grab a frozen entree and zap it for supper, or order a pizza or something to be delivered? And yes, that may not be the healthiest meal you can have.
And the other thing that bothers me a lot about that is the environment and packaging that goes along with it, and how much that gets thrown into the landfill.
And speaking of throwing things out, Lisa Martin says the second biggest mistake that many of us make is pitching food out that's perfectly good. But that one, of course, is partly because of those time stamps on products: use by, sell by, best by, expires by. And according to Lisa, except for baby foods,
those dates are pretty much for quality and not really food safety. There's a lot of food that is still good to eat past the dates that's on there, but that's what the manufacturer puts on for quality. And it's not uniform, and so it's confusing.
Now, Lisa and her university colleagues have created a series of 7 nice worksheets on cooking basics, how to plan and shop for meals and items. There's a worksheet on cooking measurements, cooking terminology, how to take whatever you have on hand and turn it into a pretty good meal. If you'd like to check those out, it's easy. Go online, search Kansas State Cooking Basics, or just K-State Cooking Basics. So, Lisa, now, you want to hear some more from the Stooges?
No.
Oh, I didn't think so. Yeah. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
A natural predator to insects harmful to cranberry plants and fruit could be the answer in developing an integrated pest management method to protect this crop. Rod Bain reports.
As many of us prepare for our holiday servings of cranberries, or just enjoy them year-round in beverage or snack form, keep in mind a couple of things. First, Americans consume over 2 pounds of cranberries per year. Second, despite growing consumption of this fruit, producers still face significant insect threats that in turn threaten crop yield reductions every year.
The Sphaganophis fruitworm and cranberry fruitworm. One of the reasons those two pests are particularly challenging is that they directly attack the fruit. We also have a major threat posed by flea beetles.
As USDA research entomologist Sean Steffen says, the larvae of flea beetles attack the cranberry plant underground, away from the impacts of any insecticides, destroying root systems as the adult beetle chews on plant leaves. While insecticides are an option for cranberry growers, Steffen and research colleagues are looking at potential natural controls as part of an integrated pest management system that could reduce both pesticide use and production cost. What may be such an option is nematodes, native to the cranberry bogs of Steffen's state of Wisconsin.
Two species together, Heterorhabditis georgiana and Osteus honorici, those two together represent our nematode blend.
What Steffen means by that is the two species of microscopic worms form a bioinsecticide. The creatures, or the bioinsecticide, is not harmful to humans, pests, or other vertebrate animals. However, the nematodes, once applied to soil, release symbiotic bacteria onto their prey's internal organs, liquefying them to allow for consumption, and later laying eggs in the remains of their prey. This creates a new generation of nematodes to address insects harmful to cranberries. He says this is specifically important regarding IPM for flea beetles, who spend most of their lives underground.
We've shown that at relatively low rates, they confer really high percent kill rates for flea beetles.
And while a large-size commercial application system for the nematode bioinsecticide is still in the research stage, Steffen says the results to date look promising for Wisconsin's significant cranberry industry.
Wisconsin alone grows more cranberries than all other states combined. So it's a major, major fruit crop, hundreds of millions of dollars in farm gate income and thousands of jobs.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
We'll be right back.
Agro Mayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. Salty, closed soils can render your crops unproductive. DSAL, formulated by AgroPlanté, is specially designed for sodic and saline sodic soils. DSAL will displace sodium and wash it out of the root zone with irrigation to enhance your soil structure, water penetration, and vitality by decreasing soil salinity. AgroPlanté's DSAL flocculates your soil to promote soil aeration and drainage. With DSAL, you'll create a better soil environment for your crop roots and optimize yield. Contact AgroPlanté today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at agroplanté.com. The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
At the recent National Association of Farm Broadcasting annual convention, there was a session titled Carbon Sequestration: What Do Farmers Need to Know? For the rest of today's show, we focused on that session. The moderator was Kara Hart of the Red River Farm Network in Grand Forks. Here now is that session.
We're going to go ahead with our panel introductions today, and I will introduce these panelists, starting from my side, going all the way to the far end. Sitting closest to me, we have Andrew Lentz. He's an Eco Services Market Consortium's policy director. He develops the consortium's strategic national policy plan to support and align with ESMC's mission, vision, and national program build-out. Andrew has more than a decade of experience in the nation's capital, serving in roles in the public and private sectors, including at the USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service. Andrew spent more than 7 years at FAS, where he supported international agricultural capacity building and development projects in Iraq, Afghanistan, and throughout Africa. He's also held positions in the U.S. House of Representatives and at a national political party. In the middle, we have Chris Harbert. Leveraging more than 25 years of experience in leadership positions at the intersection of science, agriculture, engineering, and business, Chris Harbert leads the Indigo efforts to develop a trusted and scientifically rigorous carbon credit program for farmers. Chris first joined Indigo in 2019 as vice president, where he was responsible for guiding Indigo's product and engineering teams in the development of digital agronomic tools to support row crop growers in adopting more beneficial growing practices proven to reduce on-farm emissions and sequester carbon dioxide in soils. Today, as the global head of carbon, Chris oversees all aspects of carbon by Indigo program, from scientific collaborations to corporate buyer partnerships, grower resources to business strategy, with the aim of establishing agricultural carbon credits as an indispensable resource for increasing grower profitability and environmental sustainability. Finally, on the far end, and I'm sure many of you recognize Jason Weller, he joined Land O'Lakes Incorporated in 2017 as Senior Director of Sustainability, and in 2020 was appointed President of Truterra, the farmer-led and farmer-driven sustainability business unit at Land O'Lakes. Weller currently serves as the Chair of the Board of Directors for the Soil Health Institute, as well as on the board of the Soil and Water Conservation Society. Prior to joining Land O'Lakes, Jason served as the chief of USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, the nation's largest working land conservation organization that partners with farmers and ranchers to deliver assistance to protect and improve the quality of their operations and natural resources. Prior to his role as chief of the NRCS, he worked at the U.S. House Appropriations Subcommittee on Agriculture, the U.S. House Budget Committee, and in the White House Office of Management and Budget. Really glad to have all three of you here today. Thank you so much for joining us. And before we get started with our questions, I just want to remind those in the audience, we will be taking questions from you. We're going to start with a few questions from our panelists. If you have a question to ask, I'll be keeping my eye out. Just raise your hand and we will ask that you step up to, well, I don't know if we really have to step up to the microphone to ask it. I think you probably could just ask it from wherever you're sitting, as long as it's loud. And if you have a very soft voice, then I would recommend you step up to the microphone. So I will go ahead and get us started with the first question. And I think it's very relevant. I want to hear everyone's take on this. Let's start with carbon sequestration one-on-one. What is it, essentially? And we can start with Jason, maybe, and work your way back over to us over here.
How much time do we have?
Oh, man.
I'll try and keep it brief. There's a lot of focus globally in coming out of the United Nations recent consultations and the United Kingdom around how to address the emerging challenges of a changing climate. And the takeaway is, there's a lot of different approaches to how to both reduce emissions of carbon, but importantly, per this conversation today, remove carbon from the atmosphere. And the good news is that nature's figured this out about 3 to 3.5 billion years ago. And it's this little process called photosynthesis. And in our conversation will be about today is how do we work in concert with nature-based solutions, and particularly what we at Land O'Lakes and at TruTerra focus on is working with farmers to adopt soil health management systems that utilize photosynthesis, growing crops, but through how we manage the soils and the nutrients that you apply to those crops and the rotation of the crops and maximizing the biomass on the acre and a living ecosystem below the earth. Having that symbiotic system work through photosynthesis, you can remove carbon from the atmosphere, store it as plant biomass. That biomass decomposes through natural decomposition and microbiological activity, and that gets put into a new form of soil organic carbon. And so sequestration is foundational in when you're looking for a number of different approaches to scale a resilient approach to maintain a productive and vibrant food system globally. Ensuring the integrity and function and quality of our soils are the most important things we can be investing in from a food system. The good news is that farmers have been practicing these practices, these systems for, I don't know, several thousand years. So this is not a new approach. What's different is now bringing precision agronomy, precision technology, new insights into hybrid technologies, microbiological insights in how to nurture and enhance the function of those living ecosystems. Now that's kind of this new frontier of science and where we can accelerate carbon sequestration and quantify that. And what we're now, Indigo and what ESMC and what TruTerra are working on is how do we then compensate farmers for that carbon sequestration benefit they're now providing beyond the commodity production.
Chris, you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, Jason, that was a great overview of carbon generally and the cycling of it. One of the things that we have, I think, an opportunity in the U.S., and Jason mentioned the kind of difference maybe between what we call abatement and drawdown, and there's a real opportunity in cover cropping to dramatically or make a dramatic impact here overall in terms of a number of different things, both a financial outcome for farmers, but also an outcome for the environment with cover cropping. And the advantage here in the U.S., we have a great agricultural economy. I'm from Champaign, Illinois, and I'm in the heart of corn-soybean agriculture, and I see this every day, crops growing for 100 to 120 days a year, and the field's brown the rest of the time. And as Jason pointed out, photosynthesis, something that nature worked out a long time ago, leveraging that and trying to keep those fields green for as much of the year as possible, there's just a greater opportunity for that carbon sequestration to happen. So that's the technologies where there's new technologies coming out, different microbial techniques, cover cropping species. There's any number of new companies, and we're bombarded by them, which is so awesome that these companies are out there trying to think of what's next to really help farmers capitalize on this opportunity. What I think we're all trying to do is then turn that into a business opportunity, turn that into a revenue. We're calling it a carbon crop. And how do you bring in that carbon crop? How do you turn that into a recurring, reliable revenue stream for the farm?
Do you have, on the policy side of things,
Well, also just to say, I mean, in addition to both what both Jason and Chris said, is that a lot of the same sort of land stewardship practices that were just mentioned also have other co-benefits, develop or generate other co-benefits as well, such as increased water quality and water the soil's ability to conserve water as well as improve the soil's health, which can provide habitat for pollinators and birds and have other environmental benefits, which increasingly are being sought after by companies in their sort of CSR and corporate environmental reporting disclosures, and also in compliance markets, water quality compliance markets as well. And so ESMC is really working hard to sort of quantify those other environmental outcomes as well as carbon sequestration and reduce greenhouse gases to sort of stack these environmental benefits into credits as we see the demand for these types of environmental outcomes rising in both at the corporate level but also in compliance markets as well.
Chris and Jason, we know the carbon markets seem to be the buzz as we talk more about climate change. What got your companies interested in carbon markets, and how long have they been involved in this business? Maybe we start with Chris on this one.
Yes, yeah, so we were one of the early groups to really get going in carbon at scale. We've been at it for a little over 2.5 years now, so it's relatively new. You know, we're actually in the process of our first carbon crop right now. We paid farmers 2 months ago. It was the first time that we'd certainly paid farmers for the carbon at scale. And the registry process, that really approval of Climate Action Reserve and VERA, those are two registries that kind of watchdog this area and think about the rule set of what actually classifies as a carbon credit. Those protocols were first published just a year ago. So this is all relatively new. They are scientifically rigorous and have been reviewed by a number of external academic and other NGO groups to make sure they're providing what the buyers are looking for. And the buyers of the credits really, I think, drive this. And I think all three of our groups have really tried to bring different opportunities to agriculture and to farmers from a buyer perspective. It's important that if you're going to produce a carbon crop, that there's someone on the other side, a counterparty, to actually purchase that. To make it a viable marketplace.
For Land O'Lakes, just real briefly, to plug, I guess, Land O'Lakes, many of you probably know, I hope, but we're a farmer co-op. We've celebrated our 100th anniversary this year. We started in St. Paul, Minnesota as a dairy creamery 100 years ago, and today we're still one of the largest dairy creameries in the U.S. But beyond dairy processing and production, we're also a big agronomy cooperative system. So Land O'Lakes itself is a federated co-op. And our cooperative system has about 1,000 members. So these are predominantly going to be cooperatives themselves who are providing agronomy business and support for farmers. We also have independent ag retailers that are part of our cooperative system. It's through that network, the Land O'Lakes family touches about half of the harvested acres in the U.S. So it's a huge network. The vision of Truterra, we started our journey about 5 years ago, was to, within that farmer co-op system, how do we co-design sustainable solutions that can be brought out through the agronomy network of those local co-ops out to the farmer customers? Soil health and this vision around helping farmers monetize their environmental services has always been part of the original nucleus, why we were created, to unlock new value for the farmer. We launched our carbon program this February. And we've just completed our first round of payments. So we just issued final payments this month, about $4.2 million in cash payments out to growers for their carbon services. And it was an incredible learning curve, to Chris's point, that this is all brand new. And we learned a ton. And now we're taking those learnings and looking forward to 2022 and how we start to really scale this through our network. But one of the key learnings for us was that the ag retailer really is an important component of this. They have that local relationship. They have that customer base, their farmer membership, of course. But when farmers turn to agronomy support, they also overall just trying to understand and piece together what is this new carbon market and how does it fit on my farm. Working with who you've done business, in some cases for generations, is really important. And that's our approach through the Truterra Network, our family of ag retailers, positioning them to be that service provider for soil health and now also helping farmers connect to this new carbon marketplace.
Chris and Jason, how many growers would you say have tapped into the carbon market system?
Yeah, happy to talk a little about that. In terms of program scale, we have tens of millions of acres of interest. We're now up to 3.4 million acres of growers enrolled and engaged in a program, and we're breaking that into different credit vintages. So there's a 2021 credit crop, a 22 credit crop, and we're engaging with farmers across the board. So it's a growing cohort, certainly as the price of carbon credits goes up, and we're very conscious of that, trying to make sure there's continued value as growers start to evaluate it. There's early adopters who are interested almost at whatever price, you know, and then beyond that, how do we make sure that the supply and demand balances? Right now, there's an overwhelming demand and supply is tight, so we know that prices need to go up. So we're actively working to drive that slowly and respectfully of all parties involved.
Jason?
Likewise, I mean, there's very strong interest. The challenge is translating interest actually into support in action. And even at current prices, there are going to be early adopters who I think are already on that journey or prepared to adopt these practices. But when we're thinking about the need to actually sequester or remove millions of metric tons of carbon on an annual basis, the education, the training support, the technology, really there needs to be some substantial investments in that to really be able to scale this to match, I think, grower interest. But really the demand side, we see also pretty strong interest globally in demand for either within the food and ag supply chain, so actually insetting within your grain sector or within your dairy supply chain or renewable fuels supply chain. There's a lot of growing interest to decarbonize that supply chain. But then outside of food and agriculture, there's a growing surging demand for offsets. Basically, companies are realizing in this voluntary market that they can't get to a carbon neutral or a significant reduction in their carbon impact without having to purchase offsets. But the biggest, agree with Chris, the biggest challenge is actually going to be creation of supply generation. And yes, there's definitely strong farmer interest in it, but making it actually feasible and economically successful for a farmer, that's going to be the hardest thing to do. And that's what we're focused on, and trying to provide that agronomy support for farmers.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
There are three different kinds of credit markets or payment programs available for this: private, public, and government sponsored. I wondered if Chris and Jason and Andrew, if you have anything to add to this too. What are the different options that farmers have? Maybe we'll start with Jason down there.
It just in the last, I don't know, Chris, 8 months, 6 months? I mean, I've lost count. There are at least 14 different carbon type activities out there. I hesitate to call them programs, but there are different providers that are touting the ability to transact carbon services. And it's almost monthly another entrant comes in the marketplace. So it feels kind of frothy. There's a lot of folks coming in this space. So farmers, the good news is they are now, it's sort of a buyer's market, right? A seller's market, right? Where they have a lot of different opportunities to take a look at, different opportunities for enrolling in a program. The challenge is for how do you, as a farmer, individual farmer, make sense of these different programs and actually stack them up next to each other and make that best decision, that best choice of what's going to be the right program for them. A key, though, is beyond just kind of that initial offer of enrollment, it's really understanding the fine print and what the farmer's signing up for. And sometimes these programs are asking for a long-term commitment and ensuring the farmer is really cognizant and aware of what they're committing to for the long term and what rights they retain, what rights they're assigning to the buyer, and potential financial implications of enrolling in a program. So, yeah, there's, carry to your question, there's a lot of opportunities for farmers. I think the opportunity, though, to get to your question on the public side, there isn't really a public marketplace for soil carbon. But in our view, the public can make the investment in actually helping farmers adopt these practices. The value of a carbon credit today, so what we're offering, for example, is $20 a ton to the farmer. So that's the cash the farmer gets per ton. Rough math, it's anywhere from a third to half a ton per acre. So you put that into farm math, you're talking like $8 to $12 an acre. When a corn grower is looking at grossing $1,200 an acre this year, kind of hard to get in a conversation, get them out of bed in the morning, and go chase $10, right? There's a lot the farmer could be doing on that corn acre to get a higher ROI than trying to wholesale change their whole management system on the acre. So the practices themselves, and these practices include moving into conservation tillage systems like strip till or other minimum till, no-till systems, a more diverse rotation, maybe adoption of cover crops to Chris's earlier point, precision fertilizer management. These things are all requiring technology, in some cases machinery, right, different equipment. On a per acre basis, that's kind of costly. So that's where, Kara, I think the public can really serve a role in helping farmers transition in these systems. Very capital intensive on a per acre cost basis can be significant, and that's a real barrier. And then longer term, where I think the public and private can partner together, is actually the agronomy support. These systems don't, like, it's not a turnkey on, you sprinkle some cover crop, cereal rye grass and magic happens. It takes 2, 3, 4 years through the full rotation for the farmer to really get a grip on it and start to see the positive ROI on its own, setting aside the carbon credit. And that's where I think a public investment in a partnership with the private sector to support the farmer, not just for the adoption, but the maintenance of the system. There's a huge role for USDA, state and local governments, soil and water conservation districts to play in that support mechanism, that transition.
Christy, anything else you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would add, I certainly agree with what Jason's saying. And, if we go a little bit back up one step for a second, talk a little about what Jason was hinting at. There's a connection in carbon credits. There's actually two things of value. There's the creation of the opportunity. We call that additionality, or something new, something different. We've talked about cover cropping or change in rotations, these sorts of things. That's an additional thing, something new that drives a net change or a sequestration of carbon or an abatement of carbon on that acre in that year. And then there's a permanence element. The permanence means that if that's reversed or undone in the following year, did you really do anything for the benefit of the environment? And if you haven't, what is that buyer actually purchasing? Right? Because we're basically trading here in an asset that you do not deliver, that's invisible, that's really hard to visualize and quantify. A bushel of corn, I think people have a good idea what that is. A ton of carbon dioxide equivalent gas. It's not just carbon dioxide, it's nitrous oxides, methane, and carbon dioxide together, as an equivalent, expressed as carbon dioxide. This is a very complex concept to get across, right? But it certainly is measurable. I think just like when we think about calories in a 100 calorie snack pack or something, and you don't really know what a calorie actually is. You just know that it's 35 or 40 goldfish crackers in a small bag. That's 100 calories. Well, we have to establish that same kind of thought. But it's not just, what I'm getting at is it's not just the additionality, it's also the permanence. So the need to have a long-term program or a long-term engagement, this is a different type of farming. It's a long-term annuity-based instead of an annual kind of program. So making a decision to get into carbon, it's a decision to change, it's a decision to do something new and different and stick with it over time. And from that, great value will be derived into the future. The one kind of important thing I come back to there are, you know, in terms of demand of these carbon credits, there's about five times the demand if you were to try to take all of the fuels and fossil fuels that are used to make many of the products we buy, and you were to say 100% of global agriculture could actually be used to offset some of that carbon footprint, we would need five Earths to pull that off. So a big part of this is that companies who are making products have to figure out how to get carbon out of that supply chain any which way they can. And there's a portion that agriculture can do to do that, but that's going to drive the price up. And I think ultimately getting that farmer prepared for what's coming. We see this coming. You know, companies are making commitments for 2030 and beyond that are very, very public. Public companies making public statements about what they're going to do by 2030. That's going to be real. So when you think about getting growers engaged and saying in 2025, in 2027, how are we going to best position farmers to capitalize on that opportunity? And if you wanted a farmer who's never planted corn before to be excellent at corn next year, they kind of got to buy a planter and figure it out. And if they've never done it before, that's going to be tough. Same with carbon farming. Well, I think to Jason's point, you know, there certainly is an opportunity to get them going, get them engaged, figure out how to make sure that opportunity grows with them and to position it in a public-private partnership way. Getting off the ground requires adjacent and non-colliding government support in many cases. I think that would be very helpful. You couple that with the carbon programs we're putting together, and it's a real opportunity for farmers in the short term and in the long term. I think the open market really takes off and controls this as a true business opportunity.
Go ahead and add to Andrew if you'd like. Yeah, go ahead.
Just to sort of add on to what Chris is saying, I think a lot of what Chris is saying really speaks to the need for these international standards that a lot of markets like ours, we work with impact registry called Gold Standard and their affiliate SustainCert, and I believe Indigo's was Vera, correct? The need of working with these registries to really uphold the sort of prevailing climate science, the most up-to-date climate science, and to ensure that the credits that are being generated are in fact real to the best of our ability right now and to the scientific community's ability to determine that the carbon that is being sequestered is being accurately represented, and that we're generating, that these markets are generating credits that buyers want, that they are, as Chris pointed out, making these climate commitments, very public climate commitments, and they also have their own reporting requirements through programs like SBTI or others that have standards and requirements. And so the purchasers of these credits really need to have, you know, credibility and verifiability in the generation of these credits. And so that there's, and in addition to that, fungibility across, you know, jurisdictions, you know, and we need to be able to sell certain offset credits maybe in a European market, and they have their standards as well. And so aligning these to the sort of the greenhouse gas protocols and the prevailing climate sciences is of the utmost importance. Otherwise, you don't really know what you're going to get. So I think it's just an important point to make.
Andrew, let's talk farm policy a little bit. Where does President Biden's current, rather, where are President Biden's current policies on climate? Where do they come into play in supporting carbon sequestration and the carbon markets?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know how clear they've been on some of that. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion, you know, at the SEC talking about potentially, you know, mandating climate risk disclosures, things like that. That could accelerate the need for a lot of, you know, these types of offsets and things like that. And then obviously, you know, we're talking about border carbon adjustments and things like that on steel and other, you know, aluminum and steel and other construction materials, things like that. Those often sort of trickle into agriculture as kind of the next thing. And so we're obviously aware of that. There has not been much information coming out of the administration on exactly how they want to quantify that. But I think the point is that the quantification needs to be accurate in order to avoid potential penalties, you know, for U.S. agricultural products going overseas. And so that's just one of the reasons that we really need to adhere to these international standards and be aligned with the sort of prevailing climate science of the day.
Jason, you have something to add to that?
I think just to add to the comment, the Biden administration, though, has also in their infrastructure package, right, they've basically been proponents for this public investment in the adoption of practices, these climate-smart agricultural practices is how they call it. So, for example, in the Build Back Better plan, which is this infrastructure bill that's currently in the Senate and being debated, includes an additional increase of $27-28 billion just for conservation program assistance, with the focus for cover crop adoption, for nutrient management adoption, for soil health practice adoption. And the goal is to really accelerate and catalyze at a very significant scale, roughly double the annual funding and budget for USDA's conservation programs. So it's a very significant investment. In addition to that, Secretary Vilsack, you know, head of USDA, of course, he's been very clear about agriculture's role to be a contribution, to be a positive solution for changing climate, to be a drawdown strategy, this bridge as we need to get more carbon in the atmosphere and reduce emissions. So it's a very voluntary incentive-based approach, and he's sought comments and they're working on also using more of the department's authorities to pull together a broad-scale continental approach to how to engage row crop producers, ranchers, farmers, other livestock producers, as well as specialty crop producers, in this overall holistic solution to try and reduce emissions and sequester more carbon.
Jason, I know you did some work in the Biden administration. How is the talk of climate, how has that shifted? I'm sorry, in the Obama administration,
rather.
Would
have been a very brief tenure.
Yeah, I know, right? In the Obama administration to where we are now in the Biden administration, how's the conversation changed?
To me, it's less, you know, there's obviously a lot of continuity between President Obama and President Biden in their views of the role of agriculture from a voluntary incentive-based approach and need to invest collaboratively and partner with farmers to adopt these conservation practices. What's changed, however, is I think the more receptivity and actually embrace of this conversation both sides of the aisle within mainstream agriculture. I mean, so if I think back 5-6 years ago, to even have a conversation in some audiences to even be able to talk about climate change, it was a flashpoint, and instead we had a debate whether it was called weather variability. Now we're past that, and we're now actually, how do we meaningfully engage agriculture at scale in this productive conversation to unlock new profitability and revenue opportunities for farmers in a way that meets them where they're at, in a voluntary approach, using positive incentives, co-invest, and now unlocking potential new revenue streams. That's what's changed. It's really just the whole atmosphere on this is productive and I think really positive, and it makes me really optimistic.
So another question for Andrew. What do you see as being the biggest political hurdles in getting a growing Climate Solutions Act passed in both the House and Senate?
Well, of course, we know it's passed the Senate, and it's awaiting more debate in the House. I think probably the biggest hurdle right now is obviously you know, obviously just the sort of natural partisan divide that's there. But I think actually there's a lot of skepticism, even within the Democratic caucus in the House on a lot of this stuff. And so I think that those sort of differences are being talked through right now. And actually there is a fair amount of support on the Republican side, obviously with the Senate bill passing, 92-8 with broad bipartisan support. In fact, it was more Democrats who voted against that bill than Republicans. And so we're sort of starting to see that divide shake out a little bit more in the House, obviously with, you know, just a sort of wider coalition in the House. And so you're seeing some divergence even within the Democratic caucus. And obviously probably we don't have a total whip count on this, but certainly probably less support in the Republican side in the House than we saw in the Senate side. But I know that those discussions are happening, and certainly there's a lot of support for this. Jason was just referencing this, is that the entire conversation around, you know, agriculture's ability to provide beneficial environmental outcomes has really changed even in the past 10 years. And so it's really exciting to see. A lot of the farmers we work with, I mean, they are totally on board with this. They say, you know, we don't want to even sell our outcomes to, you know, oil and gas industry. We want to do this really within our own agricultural supply chain and really have agriculture be a leader in this, in our sort of climate change mitigation strategy. So it's been really exciting to see that change. And it's fun when we work with our farmers to sort of see this. They really just get excited about the potential here. So it's been fun.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
I want to encourage our members out there who are here participating in today's session. If you've got a question, please feel free to raise your hand and I will try to get you called on. Welcome any questions that you all have. I see one in the front. Looks like Hannah's got a question. Hannah, will you stand up and say who you introduce yourself and say who you work with and ask your question?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Hannah Pegel. I'm with AgriPulse Communications. So through some of the interviews that I've had with farmers, a lot of them have kind of talked about how they don't really want the government to play a role in setting carbon markets. So I'm curious what you guys think, what the role of the government should be, and if it does have a role, what do you think that role looks like?
And anyone can, is that for anyone, Hannah? Okay.
Happy to start. I mean, I would agree with those farmers, certainly. I think there is a great, we've talked about it here, there are registries out there that are globally recognized by corporations who are looking for either insets or offsets and that message. And they've set very high, very rigorous standards that are inclusive of academia and global interests in terms of what classifies as an appropriate quantification of this change or of this new concept. So I think that's first and foremost. I would agree with the growers there. I think education, a huge element here. I taught at a university for a number of years, and we would end a freshman class with, there's this thing called cover cropping and no-till. Maybe you'll hear about them in your career. You know, that was, now we're asking growers to make that mainstream. There's a huge gap, and USDA has a great ability to go out and have an educational impact. So I think that's a great public-private partnership, certainly, is the leveraging of those assets and of those field resources to get local and get real with those growers where they are farming because they're challenged so locally. And then, of course, what we talked about earlier is the opportunity to do some type of just cash payments to growers to get over the hurdle of some of these adoption challenges. Change is hard for any of us. And it's certainly hard when you're trying to change an operation and that carries with it some increased risk. Offsetting that risk with cash payments is a great way to incentivize the right behavior. I think I would agree that I like to see agriculture move from one of the top five polluting industries globally to a net negative or a sequestrating industry. It's a great opportunity. I think we also have to then balance the concept of insets and offsets there as well to make sure that we keep everyone honest and make sure the growers get paid in the end too, and that it's not just a compressed margin world. So all that will come together. I think the government plays a good part in that, but I do kind of trust in supply and demand economics to pull it off.
To add to Chris's comments, Hannah, our journey, we've been at this for a while, and it's the good news, the strategic investment this country has made in its capacity to conserve the soil is really what sets it apart among other major agricultural nations. And the story begins in 1935 in the wake of the Dust Bowl. It's the worst man-made ecological disaster this country's ever experienced. And out of that crucible emerged the Soil Conservation Service. And we have the land grant extension capabilities. We have the Ag Research Service. If you look at all the foundational models our businesses use, our conservation practices, our knowledge of the soil, it emanates from the public sector. USDA must be the keystone that holds us together. And the continued investment in the science, in the modeling capabilities, the practice standards, is foundational to what we do. I think what the private sector can do really well is innovate on a market-based solution much quicker and I think more effectively than USDA could. I agree with the farmer. USDA should not be setting the standards for a carbon market. Let the private sector figure that out. And the iterations and innovations that are coming are like on a monthly basis. This is going to very rapidly evolve. And I think in that, you're going to have a more effective result, more scalable solution. But we need to have the public involved in investment in the foundational science. And as part of that, that Soil Conservation Service, which today is now, of course, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, and the soil water conservation movement that also emanated out of the Dust Bowl, we have thousands of professionals that work across the country working with farmers and ranchers to adopt soil health systems. And so it's working intentionally with those professionals to then bring a market solution and let them do what they're best at, which is conservation planning and practice adoption. And then through the programs of USDA. USDA has, you know, on an annual basis, issues about $6 billion in conservation payments to farmers and ranchers across the country. Build Back Better, if that's implemented, is going to be another $5 to $6 billion a year on top of that. Huge public investment in green infrastructure. That's the USDA's role. That's the USDA's specialty. And if they focus on doing that well, I'm very excited for what will come.
I mean, they both said everything that I would have said. I think, you know, certainly, Jason, thank you for saying the standards cannot be created by USDA. These markets adhere to internationally set standards and they uphold those standards. And so we would be very concerned if different countries were setting different standards for what is considered carbon sequestration. It just wouldn't work. So the other thing is, and Jason, you spoke to this too, the sort of technical assistance piece. Obviously, there are many thousands of technical, you know, NRCS professionals who are out there helping, but we need more. We need more on-the-ground, place-based technical assistance, and we need Congress to help. Jason, you mentioned the Build Back Better, but I mean, we need to be making these investments and really finding the local technical experts who can provide. Maybe that's through early adopters. These markets, they pay for new products, essentially new assets, new environmental assets. So early adopters, you know, unfortunately, they've kind of maxed out what they can do. And there could be an opportunity there. I mean, farmers learn from farmers. We know that. And if they can be rewarded for the good stewardship of the land that they've already been doing, share that expertise with your neighbor. Share that with others who are really interested in doing this. And we should be rewarding that as well. So I think there's definitely a role for government. It's not in setting standards whatsoever. But there's a lot of things that USDA does really, really well that they could be doing more of. So that's what we would probably say.
One comment I get from farmers whenever we talk about, carbon markets and the potential there is, you know, for people who are already implementing cover crops and implementing some of those conservation practices, why aren't I getting recognition for what I'm doing right now? They say they're already implementing climate smart practices on their farm. What would you tell those farmers that feel like they're already doing great things and they're not being recognized for the hard work that they're already putting into their farm operations?
This is a policy gap. So here's an opportunity for USDA and for federal policy. Those farmers are right. And given the current private market, and Chris made this point earlier, what the buyer wants is a change. They want additional carbon removed. They don't want to pay for carbon that was stored 10 years ago or 20 years ago. The challenge is you have long-term no-tillers. Guys have been doing this for 10, 20 years, right? And they're, I'll be honest, a little honked off. We talk to these guys, and I do frequently. It's like, oh, my God, double barrel. And it creates an unfortunate perception because it just doesn't make sense, even from a biological standpoint, because those fields are still pulling carbon in the atmosphere and storing the soil. So it's this additionality component that I think the marketplace hasn't really grappled with very effectively, and it's created this disincentive. So this is a policy gap. I will say, though, that is we getting aside these creation of carbon assets, the path we see is way how we include those producers in this conversation in this new market is actually looking at the commodities they produce. So instead of trying to create a separate carbon asset that you're transacting as a fungible, you know, certificate that's bought by someone outside the supply chain, increasingly the supply chain is interested in a decarbonized commodity. And if you look at the carbon intensity of a 20-year no-tiller who has done intensive cover cropping, their carbon signatures can be very different than a conventional operation. And so when you look at a low-carbon product, so if you're looking at the supply chain, whether it's from bioenergy to feed fuel, they're going to be in a really ideal position, I think, to market their commodity differently than a conventional producer. And we hope, we aspire for them to be rewarded with a premium for their low-carbon product. And that's an opportunity for these long-term soil health champions, these pioneers who have been doing this for a long time, to bring to market a different product.
In addition to that, I mean, there are new markets coming up too. I mean, not just carbon, but, you know, reduced greenhouse gas and carbon, obviously, but improved water quality, improved biodiversity. I mean, there are lots of, and as companies continue to expand on their current climate commitments, environmental commitments, and make efforts to reduce their environmental footprints, they're going to be seeking out these types of commodities that are grown in these ways and that actually restore and regenerate the soil. So I think there's new opportunities growing all the time, not just in carbon or greenhouse gases, but in other environmental benefits. So,
what other questions do you all have out there in the audience? Are there any more? Oh, I see Mark's hand going up. Mark, we come up to the mic. Again, thank you, Andrew, Chris, and Jason. Can we have a round of applause for our panelists this afternoon?
That's our show for today. I'm Sabrina Halverson. On behalf of the JCS marketing team, happy Thanksgiving.